Coming up for this week in computer hardware, 8th Gen Intel Quad-Core Mobile CPUs, the Kaby Lake refresh is fast, but not on all laptops. NVIDIA GeForce GTX 1070 Ti, we got a review. Two new Intel Optane SSDs, the PCIe 4 specs are here. And did we mention lightsabers? All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 439, recorded Thursday, November 2nd, 2017. Faster laptops and lightsabers.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twitch.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch's weekly show that, surprise, brings you hardware news. And I am delighted to say that we have the Kaby Lake refresh in force. Two laptops over at PC Per. I've got a laptop over here that we reviewed for Tech Thing. Let us discuss the doubling of the cores. And while we may not be as irritated as the not quite eighth generation mobile quad core performance, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ryan Shrout from PCPer.com.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Hey, man. I am rapidly taking all of the stuff off my old Dell XPS 139350 and moving it on to the Dell XPS 139360 because
yeah, you gotta love those rendering model numbers.
They slide right off the tongue. Although 9350 worked for me for some reason in a way that 9360 doesn't. But the 9360, you know, I did kind of what I will affectionately call an unfair comparison. I compared the 9350 against the Core i5 processor in my late 2016 XPS 13. And I was looking at the new 8th generation Core i7 8550U was delivering 80 frames per second on Handbrake versus 40 frames per second on my older laptop. So that's nice. Roughly halving the render times for videos, like 13 minutes and 30 seconds versus almost 27 minutes. Which makes sense, right? Because there's twice as many cores and twice as many threads, right? You've gone from two cores, four threads to four cores, eight threads. That's like a 200% bump in performance. If you have the last generation Core i7 7500U, you are not getting a 200% performance boost. You might be getting something in the neighborhood of a 60% performance boost.
Right.
Does that jive with your results, sir?
Yeah. Yeah, more or less. So the two machines we have here are I don't have the Dell XPS 13 yet, but we have an Asus ZenBook, which is a MacBook Air-ish type form factor, similar to the XPS 13 in terms of form factor, and the the HP Spectre X30. HP Spectre X360. There you go. Which is a larger 15-inch screen, bigger form factor. Similar specs otherwise, but bigger battery, more space for cooling, all that type of stuff. The interesting stuff that came from this is if you look at the benchmarks on the first result, like the very first one, Cinebench, kind of this classic multi-threaded flagship benchmark, and you'll see the difference between the ThinkPad X1 2017, the Core i5 standard Kaby Lake part, and you see some terrific multi-threaded performance improvements, and even some single-threaded performance as well, which is the blue bar there, because Kaby Lake Refresh does have a one or two bin bump up in frequency. What's interesting is the next graph down, Handbrake. So doing these types of things that you're working on, our two Kaby Lake Refresh machines had very different performance levels in this test, right? So Handbrake is a long-term benchmark. It's going to take 20, 30, 40 minutes to transcode video sometimes or do encoding or whatever you happen to be doing. And if you'll notice that the HP Spectre actually does much better than the ZenBook 3 Deluxe, right? in terms of the Handbrake CPU test. The reasons for which are actually thermal considerations that we get into on the second page of the story, right? So you'll see that essentially what happens is the performance of the ZenBook decreases over time, whereas the HP Spectre tends to level off and be pretty consistent.
And that is cooling issues.
That's definitely a result of thermal restrictions or whatever you want to call it, right? Where the XPS, The Spectre X360 is bigger, so they can maintain more cooling capability over a longer period of time. If you look down, I think it's the next graph after that, there's a CPU frequency metric, the orange line representing the HP machine, the blue line representing the Asus machine. And you basically see that the Asus machine actually stays clocked a little bit higher in that first like 80-second, 90-second window, if you will, on the far left of the graph. But as soon as you get past that, you start to hit these thermal bottlenecks where the HP machine is able to maintain its, you know, clock speed of 2.4 gigahertz, all cores, spiking up a little bit in between. Whereas the Asus machine needs to dip down into, you know, the 2 gigahertz and under range in order to maintain the thermal levels that it needs to for its chassis. And that's kind of played out again as you look at the CPU temperature metrics and as you look at the CPU power metrics. And the takeaway from it is not that like the Asus machine is a bad machine or the HP machine is the only good machine. It's it really comes down to how these engineers and product managers design these products. So the ZenBook is actually faster for shorter workloads, multi-threaded workloads. Even though it's in a smaller chassis, they have bent it in a way that they are willing to sacrifice their long-term thermal capability for short-term thermal capability to get you better burst workloads, essentially. The Spectre is more balanced. It's more meant to maintain the same performance levels over an extended period of time without a lot of variance, which can be good as well. The takeaway from it is if you're the kind of guy that's going to do video processing, you want the HP, not the Asus. If you are the kind of guy who's never going to do that, you care more about form factor, you like the thinner, lighter, smaller design, then the Asus machine is going to do just fine for the vast majority of things. Even if you do short-term multi-threaded stuff like Photoshop filters or really minor video transcoding that can happen in 30 seconds or something like that if you're exporting something. Those are going to be just fine on the Asus machine. And when you think about it, the super thin and light form factor that the ZenBook 3 falls into, that's the workload that they're targeting in general, right? That's the user consumer base that they're targeting. So it makes sense for them to do that. It was just interesting to kind of dive into these differences and really see them played out over two platforms that use the same processor.
I mean, we always hear a lot in theory what is going to, you know, the design theory, what's going to impact the design. And we know from benchmarking and playing around with overclocking that thermal envelopes, thermal cool, you know, basically having all of the cooling makes a huge difference. But this is, you know, because these laptops are so small and they're dumping so many more transistors on the chip, man, this is a really prime example of a little bit of difference here and a little bit of difference there is going to make for a radically different performance number across different designs. So
it's also exciting. Worth noting that I think this is something that's going to be more important as we move forward with these types of designs, like as we integrate more cores and more graphics and more technologies into these mobile platforms where we want small form factors and we have these thermal limitations. It's going to be more of this kind of give and take, right? Like, are you willing to have a super thin and light as long as you know that it's going to have these types of restrictions? Because a lot of people, there will be some people who are going to look at the numbers in this story and the numbers that you're going to put out about like, I thought it was going to be quad core, so it was going to be faster all the time, 100%. You know, why does it matter if I'm doing something for 30 seconds or 30 minutes? They don't really comprehend the engineering challenges that go behind that. Like, you just can't change physics, as it turns out, as much as we've been trying.
You can ignore physics.
You can, and you can have, you know, burn your skin, surface temperatures of your notebook, and you can have fans that are 110 decibels. Actually, that would be really hard to do. But, you know, you could do all these type, you could do other things, but within reason, this is going to be the thing going forward. So I'm curious to see what your thoughts will be on the XPS 13, because it's, again, kind of one of those smaller form factors like the ZenBook 3 is, and see how it does over a long time in terms of use cases.
The thing for me, I mean, yeah, it's going to be fun playing around with it over the next few weeks. Right now, purely looking at, you know, having run this benchmark a half dozen times in the space of an hour, just to kind of abuse it thermally, I was impressed. It pretty much held the same form. It might have dropped about 10 frames after about the fifth or sixth time I'd run it, especially once I had it, you know, flat on a wooden desktop, which is kind of a, you know, a surface that will eventually heat up, retain heat, and reflect it back into the bottom of the laptop. I mean, it's amazing what you can do for cooling on a laptop simply by putting an extra pencil underneath it, as ridiculous as that may sound. But if you've ever spent 12 hours rendering, you'll look for any way to cool something off without destroying it. But, you know, one of the things I thought was interesting is looking at the estimated benchmark or the estimated battery time is dumping the high-resolution monitor for the standard 1080p monitor makes a huge, outrageous difference in battery life in the XPS 13, which is something I hadn't really considered. And probably is you know, we're talking about like an extra 8 hours of battery life, I think, something crazy like that, a huge increase, like the better part of a doubling of battery life. But you also end up with a much smaller desktop, which would drive me nuts at this point because I'm so used to using the high-resolution desktops, both on my desktop machine and my portable machines. But yeah, I will keep everyone posted on how it holds up over the next few weeks. But at this point, you know, I'm looking at, like, if I have to render on my laptop, I can now render twice as fast as the Core i5 laptop I was using, which is not trivial. That's a huge jump. Yeah. It's also still like 70% slower than a, you know, Ryzen 1800X desktop. So my first choice is to use the giant desktop. My second choice is to use the faster laptop. And my third choice is to do it on my phone. I mean, that's my eighth choice, but, no, it's good. Other than that, though, it is literally the exact same XPS 13. You know, I have there's a fingerprint reader in this one, which is interesting, but not a huge, you know, I think I would dump the fingerprint reader and throw that money I don't know, memory or something. Like, the configuration I had is 16 gigabytes of RAM, which was double the amount of memory, but I don't think memory impacts I'll have to experiment with that. I don't think memory impacts
battery life?
sorry, handbrake. I don't think memory impacts.
No, not very much. No.
You know, not nearly as much as the not nearly as much as it would impact, say, Premiere, or as much as the doubling of the cores impacts handbrake.
Right.
But yeah, I'm excited. And, you know, the other rumor is that they're looking at some of the benchmarks I saw put the XPS 9360 with the dual cores, with the additional cores, the doubling of the cores, as like an hour better in battery life benchmarks. So that's pretty cool. Not as stringent as the PC Pro battery life benchmarks, but I'm working on that. I bought a Lux meter. I'm now the proud owner of a Lux meter just so I can run the PC Pro battery benchmark.
Nice.
And I've just been measuring light all over the place.
It's fun to do, isn't it?
Yeah, me and measuring tools just get incredibly nerdy together. Speaking of nerdy, what are your favorite segments, shows, or moments on Twit this year? We're putting together our best of episodes, and we want your help. Please. We love your thoughts. Head on over to twit.tv/bestof. Fill out the form with whatever information you remember and be a part of making these special shows that will air the week between Christmas and New Year's. That's twit.tv/bestof. Pick favorite moments. See them all over again, like for the first time, but later than the first time. Oh, my goodness. EVGA NVIDIA GeForce GTX 1070 Ti, a.k.a. the not-quite 1080 that sells for 20% less, or the most of a 1080 for 20% less, or the specs look like it's most of a 1080, but for $100 less, assuming you can actually find one for sale. Also known as the
video card most likely to irritate the delete expletive out of me because I bought a 1070 a few months ago and the 1070 Ti is supposed to sell for $400. Man. So
yeah,
huge bump in CUDA cores and GPU cores, a modest bump to 1080 levels for the base clock. Same boost clock as a GTX 1070. Another 25% more texture units, same amount of RAM, same amount of memory clock, which is a little slower than a 1080. A small boost in TDP. It's like 180 watts up from 150 watts. Peak computing, 7.8 teraflops up from 5.7 teraflops in the GTX 1070. We've said it before. We'll say it again. This is a significantly faster card, although it is not technically selling for $499 or $399. It's selling for $449, which gives it a nice midpoint, theoretical midpoint in between the 1070 and
correct,
the 1080.
Correct, correct. Yeah. What's interesting for me is you look at these specs, the GPU portion, your core mm-hmm. count, your clock speeds, those are all essentially very, very, very close to the GTX 1080, right? Right. Much closer to the 1080 than the 1070. If you look at the memory specs, they actually match the 1070. So you get the GDDR5, not 5X, slower clock speed, same 256 gigabyte per second. But then in TDP, it's actually at the same level as a 1080. Not that big of a deal, again, because right. Of the 150 to 180, not a big gap there. So when you look at these specs, and I think as we talked about last week when they made the announcement, but we didn't have testing done, is that in theory, the 1070 Ti is going to be close to the performance of a 1080. And as you look through the review, that is absolutely 100% the case, right? Like, There are several games in which the performance of the 1070 Ti matches the 1080, or is within 1-3% of it, all at stock speeds, right? The kind of average is that the 1070 Ti is 10-25% faster, or it's about 15-18% on average faster than the 1070, but it's only 5-10% slower than a 1080 in the average case. So again, it does turn out to be much faster, much closer to a 1080 than a 1070 in these instances. One of the compelling fallouts of all this, I think we talked about it a little bit last week. We noticed that all the clock speeds were the same for all of these EVGA models and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually the case across all the partner cards now. They're all running at the same speeds. They just basically did not want NVIDIA, when I say they, NVIDIA did not want any 1070 Ti retail card to outperform a 1080 retail card, right? So no super overclocked versions of the 1070 Ti can be sold because they would exceed the performance of a 1080 reference Founders Edition, spec'd card. Which is interesting to think about. And there have been some people who I've seen today, some content where people are talking about this in a really negative connotation. I say in my article, and I haven't had confirmation from NVIDIA on that they did it this way or that they're not going to do it in the future, but I have no reason to believe, and I don't think they would make this a policy moving forward. It's simply mm-hmm. a result of their very complicated product lineup, where they're trying to squeeze this part in to right up near the 1080, but not quite at 1080, in order to put more pressure on AMD's Vega 64 and Vega 56. So I think this is a one-off case where they did not plan for the 1070 Ti to exist. They didn't think it was going to be necessary, or if they did, they thought it was going to be maybe closer to that 1070 itself, in which case more overclocking on it wouldn't actually affect the 1080 at all. So when you get cards like that EVGA SC Black Edition, what you're paying for out of the box is better clock speed consistency, lower temperatures, which allows you to do more of your own overclocking manually, which is still completely 100% enabled, no issues with that. Like, you can do as much as you want with Precision X software or MSI Afterburner software, whatever it is you want to do. Mm-hmm. It is worth noting, on the second page of the story, we did have one graph that looks at clock speed and temperature, and because we had both the Founders Edition and the EVGA SC model, and the which is the SC stands for superclocked. Alan's not here, but he would normally be complaining about that. and what you'll see is that the after extended use right there, that graph right there, the blue line, it's four lines, so it's hard to tell. The blue line is the Founders Edition clock speed. So if you look towards the right half of the graph, you start to see that it's moving around quite a bit, right? The orange line just above it is the EVGA card at clock speed, stock clock speed. So it actually, it maintains its clock speed of, I think it's 1690 or something like that, pretty much all the way across. Or no, it's over 1800, isn't it? Yeah, all the way across without any really variance. And if you look at the gray line and the yellow line, those are the temperatures. The gray line being the Founders Edition, the yellow line being the EVGA. And clearly you can see EVGA one's running at like 64, 65 C, whereas the Founders Edition is at like 82 C. So there's still an advantage to buying these aftermarket cooled cards because you'll get a little bit better performance, more consistent performance, even if you do nothing else to them. But then you also, you know, your GPU running at 64 instead of 82 gives you a lot of advantage in terms of potential for clock speed overclocking on your own. So, and we did overclocking. I was able to get like 150 megahertz offset, which resulted in like a 1987 megahertz consistent clock speed. So almost 2 gigahertz on that. So that's when you start to, you know, wonder, would it be to 1080? And yeah, probably would. And that's what NVIDIA was trying to avoid, that PR discussion, I guess, if you will.
We will also point out that that was you doing that, not the vendor doing that. And as far as we know, there is no restrictions on you doing that.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Who's paying attention? Oh, my goodness. I would be more excited if I could actually buy one for less than like 500 and change. So have you seen any remotely near? I mean, with Bitcoin, I got text message from a friend last night. Yeah, it was $6,600 for Bitcoin last night. It is $6,966. Almost a biscuit, if you will, under $7,000 for a Bitcoin right now. Apparently, it smashed past 7,000 sometime last night. So I'm gonna anticipate that the mining market, despite the fact that Bitcoin isn't being mined for the most part by GPUs, is not going to drop anytime soon. I feel comfortable making this.
The inventory has been better in the last several weeks than it has been in months, right? So availability of the AMD cards, the NVIDIA cards is okay. It's not great, but it's pretty good.
Right.
The only thing I would say is, even though Bitcoin price going up may seem like an automatic negative to GPU availability, one thing to consider is all the stuff that GPUs are mining, they're not mining Bitcoin. They're mining all these alt, you know, cryptocurrencies.
Yes.
And if they aren't going up at the same rate as Bitcoin, then the value of which you are mining is actually going down relative, right? So, in theory, it could mean that would fall off. But at any point, any of this could change. So it's hard to really say. But I will say inventory is looking better. We're starting to see more cards much closer to their MSRPs. 1070, now you've got the 1070 Ti, you've got not just the fact that there's mining, but also that it's a new product. And in general, new products, brand new ones, tend to have a little bit of a surge at the beginning. So, you know, give it a week. Let's find out where the 1080 or 1070 Ti settles. And I have a feeling that we're hitting some equilibrium at this point. Not just hopeful. I think that's the case as well. We'll see.
We shall see. Oh my goodness. Intel Optane SSD 900P, 480 gigabytes and 280 gigabytes NVMe HHHL SSDs. Or as Alan puts it, lots of 3D cross points. It's mind blowing, but it has been 2 long years, as Alan notes, that we first heard about 3D crosspoint technology, Intel Micron. It's going to be amazing, guys. The lowest latency ever. They're going to last forever. It's going to be amazing. It's going to replace the memory on your machine. It's going to be memory and storage all in once. It's your dream. It's a dessert topping. It's a floor wax. So, you know, it's we've been waiting. I don't know how else to put it, right? You know, the 900P was supposed to support PCI Express 4. This is not true. And it turns, as Alan dug, it turned out to be a foreign vendor mistaking slash confusing PCI Express 4 lanes with the recently drafted PCIe 4.0 spec, which has not been pushed back upon but doesn't exactly exist yet in a physical manifestation you could build a drive for.
Right.
You know, there were lots of listings, oddities, the usual rumor marketing. Performance specs, though, seem to have been, the rumors have been pretty accurate. So we're talking about sustained sequential reads and writes of like 2.5 or 2.0 gigabytes per second, 550K to or 500K random read write performance. You know, yes, writes Alan, I know, don't tell me you've seen higher sequentials on smaller form factor devices. You know, Intel actually has a real shipping product here that you can buy. Read-write latency is pretty crazy. You know, like under 10 microseconds versus 60 to 100 for regular right. SSDs. Lovely packaging. Reminds me of any of a number of high-end 3D GPUs. It also comes with the Star Citizen chip.
Yeah, that's kind of nuts, isn't it?
You know, you get a chip purchase and a license to play the game to get the MMO, and it's not the weirdest thing I've seen bundled with a device recently, but it's definitely on the short list. What are we talking about performance on the 480 and the 280, and do I even want to know what these cost at this point?
So the performance between the two capacities is pretty much unchanged, which is different than a lot of SSDs, right, where there are gaps between different capacities. The performance for the 900P needs to be looked at in two different ways. One, in your straight line, saturated reads and writes, it is less than a 960 Pro, right? So if you look at it at, you know, 2.6 or so saturated sequentials, it's going to be slower than a 960 Pro, which I think is going to maybe raise some eyebrows and cause some questions, right? Because this is supposed to be Optane. It's so much faster. It's so much more efficient or endurant, if you will. The reason this is it's just the architecture is built in a way that's not what it's meant towards latency. It's geared towards latency. When you said it's rated at less than 10 microseconds, compared to 60 to 100 microseconds on a standard NAND SSD, that's an order of magnitude difference, essentially.
Yes.
Which is really where the benefit of this comes into play. And if you look at some of these graphs, and Alan, as normal, has a ton of data here for us to scroll through. So, like, if you look at that sequential write, it doesn't look great, right? In sequential write, it's actually up there quite high, beating out the 960 Pros. If you look at something like, actually go to the page, it's titled Performance Comparisons Client QD Weighted. And that is kind of the consumer oriented portion of our test. And that first graph right there is interesting, right? If you look at, this is a burst workload, 4K, random, the reads and writes. The orange bar is the writes. And in that case, you can see it's actually showing it being a little bit ahead of the 960 Pro. And the reason it's a little bit ahead now is because it is doing burst. It's not doing one long sequential saturated reads and writes. It's doing it in more of a fashion that we determined emulates client usage patterns. The blue line is reads. And now all of a sudden, you're not just seeing a little bit more performance. You're seeing a 4x performance increase in actual real world, you know, client consideration IOPS, right? So instead of getting 25,000 for the 960 Pro, which was the previous peak, you're getting over 100,000 IOPS on that same workload. And then if you look, you can see the difference. That's the random. If you go to the sequential, the read performance isn't as high as the 960 Pro, but the write performance is a little bit higher in terms of megabytes per second, right? So there's a lot of interesting stuff in that regard. It is essentially faster at lower queue depths than any product we've ever tested, right? And this is kind of mimicking what we've talked about with the P4800X, which is the enterprise variant of Optane. There's really not much difference between the 900P and the P4800X other than endurance ratings, where this is rated for 10 drive writes per day, which for a 480 gig drive is 4.8 terabytes written every day you can do. The enterprise one is written at rated for 30 drive writes per day. So it's really just a difference of that. You can go through the rest of his story. He looks at trim speed, mixed burst, RAID testing, because of course it's Alan. We're going to have some RAID testing and all this type of stuff. The simultaneous mixed burst. NAND has this issue where as you are writing to it, the reads speeds suffer. With Optane, that's not the case because the queue depth never really gets high enough to affect anything because it is so fast and low latent. So that's kind of one of the primary differences there. You asked about price. That's important. It's not cheap. It's not cheap at all, but it is. It's not. I would say it's less than I expected it to be. Less than I thought Intel was going to price it at. Right. So it's $599 for the 480 gig capacity. So you're paying $1.25 a gigabyte for it. $1.39 a gigabyte if you get the smaller capacity. And compared to the P4800X, that is a 375 gigabyte drive, I think that's like $1,800. So they discounted the consumer variant a lot, right, to get it down here. But there's still an argument to be had that the 960 Pro is doing better in some areas for, you know, about half the price of the 900P. But in the areas where Optane is better, it's significantly better, right? Like 4x better, or if you look at just raw latency numbers, you're looking at an order of magnitude. And then, yeah, this is an endurance rating, right? Yeah, right. Like, so Alan brought this up on our podcast last night about there was a game developer who was talking about how many times they had to compile their game. And it was, 30 gigs every time they compiled it that was written to the drive in various areas. And they had to replace SSDs, SATA SSDs, because they had been dying on them. So now if you look at that graph that you just showed and you're talking about a 2x cost difference, maybe that's not quite that's not a very big penalty to pay if you can get 10 times as many uses out of them as you could a standard, SSD. Right. Obviously, that's a unique use case, but I think there's enough of these types of unique use cases.
It's not that unique. I mean, there are a number of situations where you constantly dump massive amounts of data and then pull it off and then dump a fresh amount of they are all edge cases, but I think as you start looking at different areas, you start finding more and more and more of them. I've just been dealing with video for too long and people compiling A, giant files, or B, dealing with horrendous database workloads. So
yeah,
it's an interesting problem. Yeah. I'll be curious to see how well it does and what it ends up being in the future. Because it's not really a consumer product at this point. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Got it. Fair enough. Yeah, I'm excited about it. Like I want to see a higher capacity, even though it's going to be, $1,000 product. Obviously, we always want to see price drops, but I think for a first foray into the consumer market, this is actually really, really, really strong showing for them. And it's a differentiated product, right? Whereas flash SSDs and NVMe SSDs that have come out have difficulty differentiating and finding performance profiles that really stand out for them. There's no shortage of areas in which they can show those advantages. It's not 100% perfect across the board, right? That they win everything. But there's enough significant changes that it's making a splash, I guess. Yeah. And it did get that award from Alan there too.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience, not keeping up with the times, old school, paper laden, emotionally fraught. That's my phrase there, people, is dated. Needed a client-focused technological revolution, something that makes getting a mortgage easier for you, my friend. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple. You can fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. I like that idea, and it's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, your assets, your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twitch. That's rocketmortgage.com/twitch. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. I like the idea of an easier mortgage. Oh, my goodness. So, you guys went nuts on a cord cutting guide. Well, I thought that was kind of an interesting choice.
we're definitely going nuts. I know that.
That is the ultimate cord cutting guide link if you're watching on video. For those who are not familiar, cutting the cord is dumping your cable or satellite delivery and embracing a Comcast or Charter or any other cable service free lifestyle, which is pretty much where I've spent most of my adult life, minus a few years here and a few years there. I don't think I've had cable in like a decade. Cable internet, yes, but cable, yeah, we gave up on DirecTV.
And see, I'm still one of those people that's stuck, right? Like,
you're a sports ball guy.
Yeah, and I fear change. Let's be realistic. I don't like
okay,
Mr. I don't like not knowing. Owner. Well, I don't like not knowing what to expect. Right, with cable or the Fioptics TV service I have.
You've bought two brand new electric vehicles in the last 3 years. You change your phones on a regular basis, and might I point out the extraordinary collection of hardware in your office right now. You, sir.
Sure.
Just didn't want to give up cable. This has nothing to do with your fear of change. This has your fear of missing basketball games.
The PC I work at every day is old. It's unchanged over a long period of time. Now, the benefit is that I have all these other computers I can work on or play on if I want to do that. But because I fear the upgrade process or losing data or forgetting to copy something over and somehow inhibiting my ability to be productive for one whole day or whatever it is, I refuse to upgrade my PC on a normal basis. Anyway, and the same thing kind of happens here, right? Where it's like, oh yeah, but there was always, and it's still the case, where it's always almost enough to replace what you had, right? Where you had to worry about OTA, you had to worry about on-demand services, you had to worry about how do you DVR and record stuff that you might miss. A lot of that has been solved now. And this is a story, part one of a three-part that Jim is writing for us, that goes through and dissects like what are the devices you can look at, the Shield, Apple TV, Amazon Fire TV, Roku devices, that type of stuff. Like which one is right for you depending on your use cases.
I have all of them, Shield, but like the Fire TV boxes.
Yeah. I have a Fire TV. I have an Apple TV. I have a Shield. Like to me, the Shield is kind of like the best option for this enthusiast crowd that I think listens to these types of shows, right? Where if you have a gaming PC, you can stream to it. You can stream straight cloud gaming through GeForce Now. You can get 4K and HDR support. It's got the Google Assistant integrated with it. The Shield has kind of become the only place in which Android TV updates occur, right? YouTube TV came out for Android TV devices today. It is launching on the Shield first.
I'm going to say this. I will give my Shield, since I couldn't get anybody to buy it, I will give my Shield another attempt because it was, when it first came out, there were so few applications. There were such a tiny subset of the Android marketplace available. There were so few usable services on there that if you weren't running your entire life off a local server, it was pretty useless. So I will give it another chance. I will say if you are not doing if you're not going to stream to it via 3D gaming, you have an incredibly overpowered box. Compared to, Roku or Apple TV. And Roku,
it can also,
Roku, I think. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it can also do like, it's an entryway Plex server. It's not just a Plex client. It can be a Plex server, right? So sure. If you hook up a USB hard drive to it, or even now it supports, if you have a network attached storage device, it can access that. It can save devices to it or save content to it and read from it. And mm-hmm. It acts as the transcoding option and stuff like that. You know, we had a lot of comments in the story about like, obviously you should be building a home theater PC. And the truth is,
No, not really.
It's not a good option anymore.
If you want your home theater, if it's like your home theater PC and it's serving all of your video and your audio throughout the house and it's dealing with downloading all of your updated stuff, that's one thing. But in most situations, you're better off with a Roku box. You're better off. I mean, in terms of the investment for the performance, buy a Roku box. Buy a Apple TV. Buy a in the NVIDIA Shield, although personally I'd put a Roku probably way ahead for most people, or just getting Roku built into your next television, from TCL or Hisense. But I agree with you. It's getting to the point, it's getting enormously difficult again to play Blu-rays on Windows machines. Without ripping your stuff, just because that, when
you can only do Netflix 4K HDR content if you have a Kaby Lake processor and you use the integrated graphics.
Yeah. Right? It's irritating. The way Intel has worked with content providers to make 4K enormously difficult to propagate on anything other than the latest processor. Which is just irritating as all hell. And I didn't even want to start on that. The other thing is the mobile when Microsoft kind of gave up on home theater apps for the Windows operating system, that kind of put a lot of nails in the coffin for home theater PCs. And if you just want to run Plex or something, there's so many options to do that on set-top boxes. Fire up the hate mail or tweet in rage at Patrick Norton. Leave Ryan out of this one. He's got enough rage tweets to deal with. But yeah, I mean, it's been frustrating because like Robert Herron still runs an amazing home theater, but building a new one is just really frustrating. I don't know. I'm waxing sad over the glorious past that was home theater PCs.
Much of the story also centers around like picking a service like Sling TV, PlayStation View, YouTube TV. Right. I will say like PlayStation View, surprisingly the best in our opinion, despite the fact that it comes from Sony and it has a PlayStation brand on it. YouTube TV is pretty good. It has a more limited selection of like the cable specific channels, but it only launches in the regions where it has agreements to get all four of the locals as well, which takes away the need for OTA setup or HD home run or anything like that, which obviously was previously a really big concern because locals are for sports and all that type of stuff as well. But if they can figure out the arrangements, there's still complications like Thursday Night Football is only able to play to smartphones that have Verizon service, right? So even if you have YouTube TV running on your iPhone, but you have AT&T, it won't play that game because of contractual exclusivity, right? And that's just something that I hope to God goes away over time as opposed to increases over time. I'm not sure which direction it's actually going in right now. But that needs to be fixed if we want this to make this ubiquitous.
Movies Anywhere has given me more hope on this because it's the goal of most content creators to have their own private service for the distribution of their content that you can't get it anywhere else. Notice that, remember that Disney's leaving Netflix in 2018 or at the end of 2018. Basically because Disney's starting their own service because, hey, why not pay another $20 a month or $10 a month or whatever it costs. On the flip side, it was amazing for me to get Movies Anywhere running because there was this, I will say profoundly surreal
experience for me where I loaded it up and I connected, you know, my Google Play and my Amazon and my iTunes accounts. And I'm playing iTunes movies on a Roku box.
Ooh,
and I will, okay. I will be honest. Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest. I was sitting there and just kind of staring dumbly, mutely, kind of like I thought this would never happen. I mean, and ironically, I can now play iTunes on Roku long before I can play Amazon Prime on an Apple TV box, which we've been waiting for a long time. You know, but they basically set it up so that if you happen to have, if you've purchased movies through these systems or if you've got the redemption codes, you can, for the Blu-rays, you can make them accessible through their streaming service. Is it perfect? No. You know, I've got, I don't know, 200 plus Blu-rays, most of which I probably won't be able to get onto this service, but I can figure out other ways around that. And if you do have a significant investment in Amazon or iTunes or Google Play, it makes it cross-playable across everything, which is awesome and probably irritates the snot out of Apple and probably irritates Google and Amazon, probably not as much as Apple, but, you know, but I would love to know what the negotiation for this was like. You know, make your content available, make your users' content available in movies anywhere, or we're going to quadruple the licensing fee for movies. You're launching an Apple TV 4K, right? You do want 4K content for it, don't you? I mean, I could just imagine that particular conversation across the conference table going down pretty much exactly like that. So, you know, there's no, you know, well, you know, there's none of my television programs were showing up on that yet because it's movies anywhere. But if the if the movie companies can do it, surely television production companies can do it. In any case, I'm as excited about, I'm still blown away with playing iTunes stuff on non-Apple hardware, at least set-top boxes. So we'll see. I don't know. Are you going to give up your cable subscription anytime soon, or is the availability of college basketball just too high a price to navigate?
This story, a set of stories on PC Per exists because when it's done, our conclusion, what we decide is the best combination, is what will go in my house. Right. That was the intent behind the entire like campaign of this, right? Like, okay, let's figure this out, get it done, and I'm gonna do that. So yes.
I will be curious after you install your NVIDIA Shield TV, I want to know if you ever actually stream games on it to your home theater screen.
Fair.
Let me know.
Okay.
I am we'll curious do. If anybody's likely to do it. I think it's you. So.
Yep. Fair enough.
Oh man, PCI 4 specifications, as we mentioned earlier, are here. They're just not implemented yet in terms of real world hardware. We're talking about 16 GTs per second. I don't even know what a GT is. A gigaterabyte.
Giga transfers.
Like 32 gigabytes per second on a 16X slot. That'll also, the PCI 4 will basically allow devices to use more power. So external power up to 225 watts. The slot's going to be capped at 75 watts currently. But basically it means you're going to be able to continue to hammer away wattage on parts, which probably brings a lot of joy to Team AMD. Not to suggest that they could use some power reduction on their parts, so their graphics parts. No specific dates for products to arrive. It's 0.9, which means it's not really done yet. It's mostly done. So we'll be waiting a while before we see these show up. I doubt we will see announcements at CES. Stranger things will have happened, but I'm sure sometimes next year we'll get sort of the early announcements of the gear that we'll use PCI Express for, because Lord knows everybody wants more bandwidth. Last thought before we go. I don't have it on me because I'm hiding it from the small creature that is in the warehouse right now, but I do have Star Wars Jedi Challenges. I have my mock lightsaber, my headset, and I'm going to be lightsaber battling.
I'm going to be honest with you here.
And practicing combat.
Let me be honest with you. Our buddy at Lenovo that we are both friends with, I'm going to, like, the very first thing I'm going to do when I hang up on this Skype call is call him. Be like, okay, look. I've never really called and asked for anything more directly than this. Please send this over. Yeah. I'm extremely jealous right now.
I can tell you, I could try to be kind and tell you that it sucks and you're not missing anything, but lightsabers, virtual reality battles.
It combat. Wouldn't matter what you said, to be honest. I would still need it.
No. Holochess,
to try it,
dude.
Yes. Correct.
This is the real reason VR exists. Not for new immersive storytellings to advance the art of human communications. So Ryan and I can pretend to be Jedi.
Yes.
VR is all about.
That's it.
With
that's
that,
all
ladies
it is.
And gentlemen. Oh, my goodness. PCPro.com is a place to find more. Mr. Ryan Trout, you can find me at techthing.com or avxl.com if you're into the home theater lifestyle. Man, I can't wait to tease you mercilessly when you don't stream anything through your NVIDIA Shield TV other than basketball games. And yeah, we're here each and every week at twit.tv/TWICH. That's This Week in Computer Hardware. And if you go to twit.tv/Twitch, you will find all of the links to subscribe to the show, links to all of the older shows, and lots of useful information like that. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schroe.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.